Okay, so we are back from the world in which we occur. This is session number 3, titled Grief and Climate Change. To give you a bit of context about the world in which we occur, in case a few of you maybe didn't make the sessions on both the last sessions, which were Saturday and Sunday, the world in which we occur takes its inspiration from James Lee Byers, the artist's 1969 work titled The World Question Center, in which he phones over a live televised broadcast. He phones a number of individuals, including artists, scientists, philosophers, key intellectuals, and just overall free thinkers in society, and asks them to pose a pertinent question they find relevant for their personal work or personal practice, and pose it for an audience of listeners. In that sense, our format titled The World in Which We Occur takes inspiration from that work. However, it is addressed to pertinent scientific questions that are happening or occurring in our world today, and also the history of materiality and flux. And today we will reflect on grief and climate change, but to give you a bit of a summary from the last session, Margaret is going to give you a few words.
So last Sunday we had a session called Molecular Colonialism in the Reign of Microorganisms. And we had three guests over the phone: Stefan Helmreich from Cambridge, MIT, who's an anthropologist and was trying to stress the question of the microorganism and the biome coming to the surface as a main angle for contemporary politics and scientific thinking, and asking why is that happening and how that influences like structural thought across several disciplines. Then we were on the phone with Jana Satella, an artist from Finland based in Berlin, who was discussing management theory in relation to slime mold that she cultivates and grows in her house, and is interested in interpreting in terms of networks of power and distribution of information. So she's making this parallel between biological ones and more like managerial ones. And then we spoke to Frank Gallardo in London, over the phone, who's been doing activism in the Thames estuary and was talking about mud and about some experiments with food and with tongues, with the tongue as a receiver. So these were some of the few questions.
Today we are going to move into the core question of what is grief and what is mourning with regards to climate change. And I have a few words prepared. Essentially, the session is an investigation into the methodologies of approach to climate deniers and their reasoning, as well as the flip side of grief, how to psychologically adapt to the repercussions of natural disasters today. This session identifies the psychological response in an era of global warming on both the climate denier side of the equation, as well as victims who have weathered a natural catastrophe or event, and the effects thereafter. What is the mournable body beyond the human? Are non-human entities fellow vulnerable beings capable of our mourning? And what kind of concerted political action exists for these beings? So first we're going to reach out to Clive Hamilton. The reason why we began a little bit off schedule today is because we are contacting both radically different continents, both Australia and also North America. We're contacting Canada and the USA. So to match up both the night and morning schedules, we decided to do a little bit of give a little bit of time frame for those to wake up in the US. So Clive is currently located in Canberra, Australia. So we'll phone him, I'll introduce him, and then later we'll proceed to ask him to pose questions that he feels is pertinent today. Hello, Clive?
On hold. Hello?
Hello, Clive?
Yeah, hello.
Hello, hi, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Good, good. Sorry, we had you on hold there for a minute. This is Jennifer and Margarita live in the CAC cinema, calling from the world in which we occur. We're going to proceed to introduce you, and then you can pose the questions that you find are pertinent today.
So, Clive Hamilton is an Australian academic and the author of a number of books, including Gross Fetish, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truths About Climate Change, and most recently, Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. He's currently writing a book on the larger meaning of the Anthropocene. Clive was the founder and, for 14 years only until 2008, executive director of the Australia Institute, the nation's leading progressive think tank. He is currently professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra. He has held various visiting academic positions, including at Yale University, Sciences Po, and University of Oxford.
Okay. Can you hear us well, Clive?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
And the audience, do you hear everything well? Good. Okay, go ahead and do you have some questions to pose to the audience today?
All right. Well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak at this event. I think the topic that I've been asked to speak about is one that is very difficult for us to deal with. It's not the kind of issue or question that we really want to think about. But I think, I believe we have an obligation at this time in the history of the world, if I can put it so grandly, to face up to the truth that is of what the climate scientists are telling us about the way in which humans have are transforming the Earth, Mother Earth, as we know and love her. So the question I want to pose, the first question I want to pose, and it's the one I still struggle with, even though I've written a book about it, and that is the question of how do we face up to the truth? And having faced up to it, how do we cope with the truth? How do we deal with it? How do we handle it? And I think we have to ask this question because we need to take very, very seriously what the climate scientists are telling us about the path, the trajectory that the Earth is on. When we look at what the nations of the world are planning at the moment, even as we go into the very important Paris Conference of the Parties later this year, if the governments around the world fulfill their promises, and of course they may not, then the world remains on a path to being warmer by 4 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. And bearing in mind that the Earth has warmed by about 0.9 degrees since pre-industrial times. And even if we're very, very optimistic about the way in which the governments of the world and business and technology will develop, it seems very unlikely that we will be able to prevent warming of the world by at least 3 degrees. And this will represent, even under optimistic assumptions, a radical transformation of the state of the world. The world will be warmer than it has been for millions of years. The conditions of life on the planet will be changed. We will face very extensive sea level rise that will go on for many centuries and will essentially be undoable. There will be a whole transformation of the climate of the Earth, and not just the climate, because the climate system is of course connected to the other great components of the Earth system, the biosphere, the hydrosphere, the watery parts, the cryosphere, the icy parts. Ecosystems will have to undergo a change at a pace, a rapid pace, that most of them simply cannot deal with, and that's why we are talking, the climate scientists or the biological scientists are telling us that we are in the midst of a worsening mass extinction event, one of the sixth mass extinction of life that the Earth has seen. So when we confront these truths, which are now pretty much incontrovertible, the question is, how do we cope? How do we deal with it psychologically? Because it's such a radical transformation of the way we understand the world and the future and our own lives and those of our descendants, that it seems to be overwhelming. And when we look at how people are coping around the world, people adopt a number of strategies. The most obvious, I suppose, and the most blatant coping strategy is to simply deny that it's happening, just to say the scientists must be wrong, or if you are James Inhofe, the infamous US senator, it's all a gigantic hoax that somehow thousands of scientists around the world have got together and conspired to develop this global warming theory and are publishing paper after paper in the scientific journals, which all point to reinforcing this this hoax that they've cooked up. That's one way of responding to the facts, to imagine that it's simply been invented to try to take away the American way of life, or to impose undue costs on people. Of course, this is a catastrophic approach to the scientific facts, and we're seeing just how catastrophic it is in the way in which denial in the United States and in my country, Australia, has slowed down the world's response to the scientific warnings. Another way of coping is to not so much deny the science, but simply to evade it, to avoid it, to turn our faces away from it, possibly to bury ourselves in hedonism or pleasure seeking. And I think this kind of evasion of simply turning our faces away is a very widespread phenomenon. And in a way, one cannot be critical of people for doing it. I mean, it's just too difficult sometimes to live all of our lives, every hour of every day, with the reality of what the climate scientists are telling us. Another strategy that people use is blame shifting, to say, well, it's bad, but it's not my fault. It's those Chinese people. They're now responsible for the largest portion of greenhouse gas emissions in the world. A very common way of coping is to engage in wishful thinking. And I think we all, one way or another, practice this form of evasion, that we imagine that something is going to come along and save us, that we develop kind of false hopes. I'll say a bit more about hope in a minute, but I think the question of hope is one that we really need to ask ourselves. Because all of us, and more so in some cultures than in others, we have an enormous investment in hope. It's kind of the sensibility that fills our consciousness on a daily basis. But hope can also lie to us. A phrase I used after Obama's autobiography, The Audacity of Hope. I refer at times also to the mendacity of hope, the capacity of hope to lie to us. But I think that we need, truly, as rational human beings, if I can use a phrase like that, an enlightenment phrase like that, sooner or later we all have to face up to the shock of the truth of what the climate scientists are telling us. And when we do face up to this truth, I think the natural thing for human beings to do is to despair. I mean, if we're not feeling despair at certain times, then we're really not listening to what the climate scientists are telling us. And we're going to a process of mourning, of grieving. And so what are we grieving for? And I've thought a lot about this. And I think what we grieve for when we face up to the truth, when we experience the shock of the truth, we are grieving for a lost future. Because if we think about it, we all implicitly and often explicitly carry around with us a perception, an understanding of what the future will be over the next few years, over the next few decades, if we start to think further in advance, if we think about the world, the societies, the cities in which our grandchildren will grow up in, say, 50, 60, 70 years' time. We have a kind of vague idea that the future will be an improved version of the present. We're so used to looking at and understanding and experiencing a process of constant development of growth, even if it's in the very narrow way, kind of growth represented by economic growth, growth in GDP, but more broadly, improvement in standards of living, in greater technological innovation, in the kinds of things that we can do in life, the access to facilities, to technologies. We have this idea that the future will be an improving version, a better version of what we have now. But if we face up to what the climate scientists are saying and imagine or form a picture of the kind of world that the climate scientists say will prevail, as best we can estimate, in a world warmed by 3 degrees or 4 degrees, that future that we carry around with us collapses. We see a world that will be full of struggle and difficulty and suffering and a species extinction and rising seas. And so we mourn for this lost future. Feel as though we are deprived deeply of something that really sustains us in the kind of deepest psychological way. And so I think it's natural to experience a process of grief, the shock of disbelief that it brings about, then the kind of strategies people use, we as humans use, to regulate the flood of unpleasant emotions in order to be able to cope with daily life, to suppress the kinds of anxieties and despair that this transformation brings about. And so, I've seen this process occur, well, I've watched in myself, but also in some of those around me, friends and colleagues who have gone through this process of facing up to the truth and recognizing that this castle that we have erected in our minds, this castle of the future, suddenly has had its foundations pulled away. But it's also true that humans, for the most part, get over their grief. They pass through the process of grief, not always completely, and sometimes returning to it. And so I think when I first wrote my book, Requiem for a Species, about 5 or 6 years ago, very few people wanted to read it, and that included many environmentalists who were not at the point of recognizing the true difficulty of the situation the world is in. But I think that's changed in the last 3 or 4 years, and many more people are facing up to it, and they're despairing and they're angry and they're despondent, but they're also recalibrating how they understand the world and what they can do, how they can best respond, both personally, but more important, politically, or as citizens rather than as private individuals in this new situation. And so I think we've seen a transformation of the environment movement, a transformation that is still in process. So it's hard to know where it will be in 5 or 10 years' time, but we've seen a really marked change in the sensibility and the strategy and the thinking of how people are trying now to respond to this terrible threat. And so, more recently, at the moment, I'm trying to grapple with what this all means as a kind of broader philosophical or even a theological level. And one way to think about it, when we go beyond the individual and think of the species, if you like, humankind, and our history, our destiny on this planet, is to understand it in terms of this new idea which has emerged out of the earth sciences in the last few years, the idea of the Anthropocene, this new geological epoch which many earth system scientists say has now arrived, and that is a new epoch in the geological timescale, which is dominated by the impact of human beings over the other natural forces that have always determined the evolution of the planet in its 4.5 billion year history. And the Anthropocene has arrived in the last several decades after the previous epoch known as the Holocene. And the Holocene was a very unusual period in the history of the Earth. If you look at the climate and geology of the Earth, it lasted only 10,000 years or so, and it appeared after the many millions of years of ice ages and warm periods, a tremendously variable period in Earth's history. And suddenly, about 10,000 years ago, the climate of the Earth stabilized. Its radical changes and swings and fluctuations stopped, and a warm and clement and pleasant climate arrived. And it was in this regular, stable and warm climate, warm but not too hot, that human civilization was able to emerge, because there was a regularity in seasonal variations of ice formation and glaciers and then ice melting and flowing into the river valleys of those great rivers in the Middle East, where civilization emerged through agriculture. And it was when people stopped being hunters and gatherers and settled down and began to build and make towns and become agricultural settlers, it was then that we formed what we understand as societies. We developed laws, we developed knowledge, mathematics, for example, emerged. We started to understand the earth in much more deeply. And the basic building blocks of modern society were laid down then. And it was because of the Holocene that we were able to do that. And now the climate scientists or the earth system scientists are saying that human beings have become such a powerful influence over the earth system as a whole, not just the landscape or the oceans or even just the climate, but the evolution of the earth system taken as a whole, as a total dynamic evolving system. Human beings have become the dominant force through the power of our technology, so much so that we've left behind this warm and pleasant era of the Holocene, and we've moved into a much more dangerous and unstable geological era known as the Anthropocene. It's unprecedented in Earth history. It will be very, very long lasting. For example, the scientists are now saying that the warming that we are bringing about in the Earth, 3, 4, 5, hardly even what to say, 6 and beyond, this warming will last for such a long time it becomes locked into the Earth system as a whole. It will last such a long time that it will suppress the next ice age, And scientists are now able to predict, because of predictable changes in the Earth's wobble and the way it rotates around the Sun, that the next ice age is due in 50,000 years' time, when the Earth would be plunged into an icy period. But now scientists are saying the warming of the Earth due to greenhouse gases and human activity will last such a long time, virtually no matter what we do now, that it will suppress that next ice age. And because the Earth will be too hot for that natural cycle to occur. And so what we're going into is a period where the weather, the climate system, and the Earth system as a whole will be uncontrollable. We will no longer be able to influence it. And so the Earth scientists who write about this, the Anthropocene of the era we're going into, they look around, they cast around for metaphors to try to capture what's happened, because science itself does not have the words to describe this transformation in the state of the Earth. And the Earth system scientists have started to use terms like the sleeping giant waking up, or the angry beast which has been poked and prodded by humans to such an extent that I'm thinking now, these are the questions that are troubling me, and they're very, very difficult questions, I think, for all of us, and that is, well, what does this mean? What does it mean if we have reached this junction in the history of humankind, and indeed in the history of the Earth itself, where we have this new force of nature, human beings, that have so transformed the Earth that we now dominate the forces of nature that have determined the history of planet Earth for 4.5 billion years? What does it mean for human beings to become geological agents, so that the scientists are saying we need to add to the geological timescale this new epoch, the Anthropocene? So how does that change our understanding of who this creature, the human being, is? You know, what are we? What kind of creature are we that we have now, we now dominate this planet to such a degree and in such a damaging way that we have to confront these deepest questions about the nature of human existence on the planet? Was this written into the destiny of the planet, of human emergence, of this new powerful force of nature? This conscious, willing being, which is so radically different from every other force of nature that has influenced the Earth, because it has consciousness, it has will, it has the capacity to make decisions in the way that no other force of nature can. Why was this creature put on the Earth, this creature that could take the future of the planet into its own hands? Why was this creature given free will and the capacity for technological transformation, this enormous power that we now have in our hands? What was the purpose, the function of having this creature arrive? Was it a test? When we were given or took our free will, our freedom, you know, at the dawn of modernity, and then developed this massive technological power during the Industrial Revolution and ever since, was this a test of our moral character? Was it a test of whether we would use this extraordinary power for good or for ill? Would we use it to care for the planet or to neglect it, to attempt to take control of it like some Prometheus on steroids? Or would we exercise this extraordinary power with caution, with restraint, in order to preserve, to cultivate, but also to preserve this planet which seems to have been bequeathed to us? It seems to me that this question of free will, as opposed to the massive technological transformative power that we have, is one that we have to open up afresh. It's the kind of question that has not been discussed by the philosophers or indeed the theologians since the great debates of the modern era, 200, 300, 400 years ago. And I think one of the signs that we have to meet these great questions of human existence and human destiny was the encyclical of Pope Francis, Laudato Si, which came out a month or two ago, which I think is a very historically important document. And one of the things that most struck me in what Pope Francis wrote in his encyclical was he said at some point that God is disappointed in human beings. God is disappointed in this creature that he created. And this struck me very forcefully, whether one is a Christian or a theist of some other kind, or like me, not a theist at all, although someone with a religious sensibility. It struck me very strongly that if God, if the creator being, is disappointed in his chosen creature, if I could use those Christian terms, what are the implications? What does a disappointed God do? Does he save this errant, fallen creature? Or does he abandon this disappointing creature to the fate that we have brought upon ourselves, not to mention all other creatures on earth and the functioning of the earth itself? So I'll finish on that point, and I think it's the most powerful one that we can all reflect on. The question of what does it mean to have brought the earth to the state that it is now in? Is the divinity disappointed, sad about the failure of this creature which came onto the earth with so much promise, with so much hope, but has become a delinquent species, so much so that it has transformed the earth, it has transformed the earth for thousands, tens of thousands of years in a way it was never meant to be.
Thank you very much, Clive.
Thank you, Clive, for your contribution.
It's good to hear from you, and we'll be in touch soon.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so after those reflections, we're going to now move over to a different perspective from Ashley Consul-Willocks, who's located in Cape Breton in Nova Scotia in Canada, one of Canada's provinces. And we'll introduce her once we have her on the line. So.
Hello, Ashley?
Hello, Ashley? Ashley?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear us?
I can hear you now.
Good morning. It's quite early over there.
Oh, it's not too bad. Just quarter to 8 in the morning.
We just spoke with Clive Hamilton over in Australia, just about to go to bed, and now you're starting your morning. So we'll proceed. I'll go ahead and introduce you, Ashley, and then we can move forward to address your questions here to our audience.
Wonderful, thank you.
Ashley Consul-Willocks is a Canadian academic and passionate environmental advocate working at the intersection of place, culture, health, and environment. She's been working with the Inuit and how would I pronounce that? The Nunatsiavut?
Nunatsiavut,
okay. Labrador on the psychological impacts of a changing environment, pioneering work in climate change and environmentally based grief and mourning. She's a member of the Royal Society of Canada's College of New Artists, Scholars, and Scientists, and was named one of the 75 Women for Nature by Nature Canada. Go ahead, Ashley. Do you have some questions that you could pose to our audience today?
Wonderful. Thank you. Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here and to be part of this session and this great way of sharing information and posing questions. And in particular, the topic of grief and climate change is something that really occupies me. And I think if you talk to my family and friends, they'd say potentially consumes me because it's something that I seem to live every day with my work and my research. So I think the questions that I'd really like to pose today are three, and they're quite nuanced. And I think, like when you pose questions in these areas, they're so complex and they're so big and they're so far-reaching that they have so many little ins and outs and so many pieces and entry points that you can come in at. So my first main question is, you know, within this context of climate change, what counts as a mournable body beyond the human? We have a lot of rituals around grieving people, and we have a lot of rituals around grieving personal loss, as well as larger loss. If you look at things like the AIDS quilt to commemorate those who have passed on, if you look at Holocaust memorials, you know, other sort of large places where people can gather and express grief together. But we don't seem to have that same opportunity when it comes to the more than humans, you know, our feather, furred, insect kin, even things like bodies of water and mountains and all that. And so what I think a lot about is, you know, there are bodies that simply don't matter and that have been sort of systematically and disproportionately derealized from a lot of our ethical and political discussions. And I think that when we're talking about climate change, this is one of the most important things that we can start to consider because there is sort of destruction and there is change. And what happens to the bodies that we don't consider that matter, and what happens if we were to change that conversation to matter. And within that, and I'll tell you a little story in a second, I'm also including, you know, bodies such as Inuit bodies or periphery bodies or those who are marginalized within these climate change discussions as well on a global scale. One of my other questions then tied in that is if we have, you know, this grief tied to climate change, why are we not sort of doubled over in pain thinking about this? Or if we were to flip that question around, is it possible to hold this grief and not get crushed by it? You know, how do we move forward in a way that ecological grief and mourning becomes politically and ethically motivating? I think that's a question that I think about a lot is, you know, as you experience your own potential grief around environmental loss, or if you witness others experiencing that loss, or you think about truly kind of what's happening at a global scale, it can be incredibly overwhelming and it can be incredibly difficult. And I know a lot of my colleagues and a lot of environmental activists and friends, there's this sort of desperate driving force behind what we do. You know, there's a need to act or we're concerned about what's going to happen. And I think the more you work in this area, the more you know, and the more you know, the more there's sort of that desperation to act and change before things, you know, continually get worse. But I think with this work is also a deep sense of loss and despondency and sadness. And I know a number of my colleagues and my friends really experience some tremendous sadness and grief and depression, and sometimes it can be completely immobilizing. And so within those questions, you know, if you know, what counts as a mournable body, and how do we hold grief without getting crushed, and then how do we move this ecological grief beyond where we're at to become this politically and ethically motivating force, so that, you know, grief becomes that mechanism or that hinge that can bring action beyond kind of where we're at. And so the reason why a lot of this has come to the forefront for me is really work that I have been doing with Inuit and Nunatsiavut, which is in the northern part of Labrador in Arctic Canada. I've been working in partnership with the five Inuit communities in that region. There's about 2,500 Inuit that live there, and they and their ancestors have occupied that traditional territory for over 4,000 years. So there's a deep, deep connection to the land, a deep connection to the rhythms of the earth, and really the land and the earth is everything. So back in 2009, I started the work, but by 2011, I was spending substantial amounts of time in the community, really talking to people about how climate change was impacting their lives. And so I spent a lot of, you know, hours in people's homes and out on the land and really seeing the changes and what was happening. And by 2011, I hit a point where I felt completely bereft. I was at a loss sort of intellectually and emotionally. I remember feeling completely adrift in kind of this unexpected grief, really unanchored from my life and really unanchored from my academic work and really unsure about how to process what I was experiencing with this sort of, you know, it was almost like a deep sorrow that didn't have a name or didn't have a way to ritualize because I wasn't sure how to make sense of it. And I think the roots of my bereavement were really coming from witnessing this ecological loss. And so I remember this point where I was sitting in the living room of one of the local elders and we had really developed a relationship over the previous couple of years. And we were talking and we were looking out the window and we were talking about what it meant to have this connection to the land, to have thousands of years of ancestry sort of coursing through your body and your veins and to have this rhythm of the environment disrupted suddenly and rapidly within kind of the last two decades. And so this woman was explaining, you know, that she was born and raised on the land before the forced settlement of Inuit into communities. And that the land was really her people, her cathedral, her life. It was a place of healing. It was a place of nourishment and survival. And it was also kin. It was a living spirit. And so we were talking about the recent changes that she'd been witnessing and what it meant. And so within that context, in the last 10 years, Northern Labrador has lost 73% of its sea ice. And so for Inuit who rely on the ice to travel, to hunt, and to survive, this is incredibly disruptive to all aspects of their life and their culture. And so she was explaining all of these things, and she was kind of systematically blinking out, you know, here's the changes to the plants, and here's the animals, and here's the ecosystems, and the bodies of water, and the storms. And so, you know, she was kind of listening them out, and then I asked her, I said, you know, how do you feel? How do you feel about these changes? And I remember the moment where she paused, and she looked at me, and then she began to cry. And she cried because of the pain she was feeling of watching the changes. She cried for the impacts it was having on her family and her people. She cried for the sense of loss that was coming in cultural practices that were disrupting thousands of years of history. And she cried for the changes that she was seeing on the land, both what she was seeing and kind of the anticipatory grief around what was likely to come. And I remember sitting there and we were sharing that moment and I was watching this grief, this raw grief related to climate change, and I started to cry too. And I cried because of witnessing and being a privileged witness to the depth of this powerful connection and to what it was doing to communities and to people and to culture. And I also cried because of my own guilt for my complicit involvement in these structures that contribute to anthropogenic climate change, you know, and my own sadness at the loss of species and ecosystems and, you know, previous loss that I had experienced in my life around environmental-based things. And I remember that was an incredibly altering moment for me. It was very transformative. It changed me in a way that I didn't understand at the time, and I think I'm still making sense of sort of years later. And it really sort of left me feeling both weak and empowered and full of despair and full of hope. I remember thinking at that time that ecological grief was something that we don't talk about often. And within this kind of context of climate change, people weren't having these discussions. People were feeling it all over the world. I mean, certainly the Inuit I work with were, and as we've moved forward, many, many other people, whether they're Indigenous or non-Indigenous, have come forward with these kind of grief responses as well. And so I think in many ways, our theories and our philosophies are behind what people are actually feeling and speaking. And I remember kind of thinking that at that moment that this was something that I needed to seriously think about. But what ended up happening was she wasn't the only one. And so there was over 100 people that I spent time with who had the same response and the same level of crying and grief. And so I became consumed in that as well. And I hit a point where I felt I couldn't go forward in this work. And I was passionate about it, and I felt I had a responsibility to work with my colleagues up north who wanted to tell these stories and wanted to share it. But I wasn't sure how to move forward, and I didn't think that I could because of this grief. And the turning point for me was when one of the elders up north said, you know, grief doesn't have to be debilitating. Grief can actually bring us together. And now that we're all talking about this, and we're talking about it as a community, and we're talking about it as a group, we have the responsibility to do something. And it was really interesting because individually those people were not sharing with others the level of grief that they felt. But when all of the stories and interviews came together, it was very clear that this was a community-wide and a region-wide phenomenon. And so people started to talk about it, and they started to consider the questions that I posed at the beginning about, you know, what counts as a mournable body. And why are the Inuit themselves derealized from a lot of political discussions around climate change, you know, and completely marginalized? And why is the more than human world that they see as a living kin, why is that bodies that don't matter? And what would happen if we could re-realize them back into the political and ethical conversations? And then the other piece that we really discussed as a group was what happens then, you know, if you experience those doubling over in pain, if you feel consumed and you can't move forward, how can we create communities or rituals to mark ecological grief, you know, and how can we talk about mourning in a way that shows our responsibility to the more than human world, that shows our responsibility to changing our actions and to pressing for advocacy and to moving forward in political conversations. A scholar, Clifton Spargo, he talks about resistant mourning and mourning that becomes a protest against injustice and oppression, and mourning that's public and that's about sharing your grief and talking about it and having conversations like we're having today to bring attention to kind of what is often silenced in larger political discourse. And, you know, I think that Judith Butler talks about what can be gained if we carry in grief, if we really hold on to the grief and we allow it to push and force our actions. What can be gained from that? And I think that this is a conversation, particularly within climate change and environmental degradation, that really needs to be had on a larger scale. And it's something that I'm hearing more and more of, and I'm having more and more conversations. And there's more and more activists talking about it. Psychologists are bringing it up. More and more discussion on kind of it, within the media, even you see pieces coming up around this. And I think it's really exciting to have that and to have this moment where we are able to bring our own individual grief up to the collective, which then may allow us to come together and really, really act and really make change and really allow mourning to be healing and politically mobilizing and really allow our theories to catch up to the lived experience. And I think that, you know, when we have this ability to mourn the loss of other species or other bodies beyond ourselves, whether they're human or ecological or hydrological or mineralogical, you know, I think that it allows our sense of participation and responsibility within this fabric of life. And I think it allows us, it's almost a restorative practice, an emotional practice, an intellectual practice, a political practice that brings us an awareness of the bonds that we have to other life forms and the responsibility that we have. And I think that in that context, then, it's not just about sharing one's sadness and bearing witness through these losses. It's also publicly testifying to them, and it's sharing them, and it's finding others who can share them and finding ways to support each other within that. And this ecological grief will likely look very different than the grief and rituals that we have for humans. And I think that's another important question that we really need to consider is what do we do in that context, and how do we, fight against the dominant discourses that derealize so many bodies from what counts as a mournable body, from what we're allowed to mourn, from what we're asked to mourn or not mourn, and what do we do when we're confronted with our own grief and our own loss? And so I think, you know, one of the things that the elder had said to me that's always stuck, and I really think it's kind of the way to wrap up some of these questions, is she said to me, you know, mourn what cannot be saved, because that's where the loss is. But then defend like hell what can be saved, because that's where our responsibility is.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you very much. It's good to hear your questions and your concerns here with us today. We'll be in touch with you soon, Ashley.
That's great. Thank you. And best of luck with the rest of the day.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up today with our last speaker, who is Lori Gruen. We're calling out to Wesleyan. Well, she's located in Wesleyan University. She leads the philosophy department there and also coordinates Wesleyan Animal Studies. But Margarita will introduce her directly when we have her on the line. Hello, Lori.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good morning. Hi. This is Jennifer and Margarita here at The World in Which We Occur. We're here with an audience here in Vilnius.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good.
It's quite early over there. We're reaching you quite early. So Margarita's going to introduce you, and then you can move forward to pose your questions to our audience today.
That sounds fantastic.
Lori Gruen is currently professor of philosophy, environmental studies, and feminist, gender, and sexuality studies at Wesleyan University, where she also coordinates Wesleyan animal studies. She is a fellow of the prestigious Hastings Center for Bioethics. She has published extensively on topics in ecofeminism, animal ethics, and practical ethics more broadly, and is the author of 3 books on animal ethics, most recently Entangled Empathy with Lantern, 2015, and the editor of Ecofeminism, Feminist Intersections with Other Animals and the Earth with Carol J. Adams, and in Bloomsbury, July 2014, and Ethics of Captivity with Oxford, 2015. Please go ahead, Lori, do you have some questions for us today?
Hello? Lori?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Are you there?
I will try to raise a series of questions now. Is that a good idea?
Yes.
Good. Yes, exactly. You can go ahead and proceed to...
Okay, great. So I recently came across an image that was on the internet of a polar bear who was floating on a small piece of ice, and she was very, very skinny, emaciated, really. And I think that the idea of the image was meant to convey that the bear was starving and that this was a result of our changing climate. And the image got me thinking, really, whether or not the bear was in fact starving, or whether or not if the bear was starving, this was a result of climate change. The image really got me thinking very vividly about the fact that we are not the only animals, humans are not the only animals that will lose as our climate changes. Other animals, it seems, will also suffer, burial, lose their families and their homes and their habitats and their communities as the climate changes. And this really, I think, raises an important question. Will other animals grieve as well as human animals grieve when the climate changes? And this is one of the sort of central questions that I've been pondering. And I think first what we need to do in thinking about this question is ask whether other animals do grieve and how. If other animals don't grieve at all, then, of course, grieving the specific changes that climate change has already invoked and will continue to spread, I think is a really sort of interesting question. So first we need to wonder, do other animals grieve? And how would we know if they do? I think it's a kind of a set of interesting questions. And there has been studies that have been done to show that other animals really from as small an animal as a rat to as large an animal as an elephant, have very rich and complex emotional lives. There's been a series of studies that have been done to show that rats would prefer to help another rat who is in trouble, either locked in a container or drowning in water, rather than save themselves often or go for something like chocolate or a really desirable treat of some sort. And that's led people to suggest that rats actually are empathetic, that they care about other rats. And that leads me to think that the loss of at least others, conspecific community, family in animals, is going to be significant and already is significant when other animals lose their companions, that they may actually grieve. I think there's a whole other set of questions about whether or not it's appropriate or desirable to drown rats, trying to figure out whether they care about each other. Those are another set of questions, maybe for another time. We also see, too, that in elephants, there's been a tremendous amount of observation among studies that have suggested that elephants who live in strong family units that live up to 60 years, that travel together in multi-generational groups, primarily headed up by female elephants, have very strong emotional attachments to one another. And we also have seen, there's a lovely book by Barbara King called How Animals Grieve, in which she sort of documents a lot of this these studies. And what happens with elephants is that they have been shown to hold vigils for a dead family member, and that they return to the site of a fallen matriarch. And there's also been recent studies that suggest that some of the more aggressive, irregular behavior of young elephants who have witnessed the slaughter of their family members, researchers are suggesting that that can be attributed to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So, animals, I think, do have rich emotional lives, and grief is one of them. And I think there's a really interesting question about whether animals may actually grieve as the climate changes and causes them to lose habitats and to lose loved ones to starvation, to drowning, and to other effects of a changing climate. So that's, I think, really one of the very sort of tricky questions in thinking about grief and in the period of a changing climate. But another question we might wonder is, why should we worry about animals? Because there are so many humans who are suffering. And I think that's a really important question as well. But many of us already do grieve the death of, many of us humans already are grieving the death of other animals. So another way of thinking about grief, other animals, and the changing climate is to recognize that often it's humans who are going to grieve the loss of the other animals. So it's not just the other animals that are going to grieve the loss of their conspecifics, but it's also humans who are grieving. And many of us are already grieving the deaths of other animals pretty much on a daily basis, when they die on the road, when they die at the hands of wealthy trophy hunters that travel to Africa to kill beloved lions, when the animals are dying in factory farms, or when they go extinct, a rhinoceros species, another rhino species has just been declared this week. So this is grief that humans are experiencing that largely remains unacknowledged, and ultimately we might think of animal lives ultimately as ungrievable, right? So we grieve the loss of animals in silence, in large part because we're thought to and expected to pay more attention to the loss and the sacrifice and the suffering of other humans. I'm often brought to a thought that I'll share. We now live on a planet that has elephants,
and a few, very few rhinoceros, and a dwindling number of orangutans. And I imagine getting older and having students or grandchildren who ask, what was it like to live on a planet where there were elephants, or where there were orangutans, or where there were polar bears or rhinoceros? So imagine that in our lifetimes, whole species of animals that we may not ever encounter close up, but we know share the planet with us, are gone, are lost. What does that loss mean for us? How does that loss reflect back on not just how we imagine ourselves, but what we've done? I think this is a really profound and moving question. But back to this question about why worry about other animals when there are humans suffering, because I think this is it's really the central question that a lot of people raise. And I think importantly, there are a lot of humans that are in positions of disenfranchisement, humans that will become the first climate refugees, much like Syrian refugees in the news at the moment. And I think what's really important to think about in the context of the humans that are suffering is that, and particularly humans that will be suffering first and intensely from changing climates, is that they are, in many ways, somewhat disempowered and voiceless. They're in positions where their lives and their ways of being in the world are much farther from sort of the mainstream view, and their suffering remains at the margins. And their voices are often inaudible. So just as animal lives are ungrievable, the voices of many humans who will be suffering as a result of climate change are hard to hear. They're voiceless in a way. And this brings to me a tie between other animals and the most at-risk humans in the face of climate change. These are the voiceless, really, and those of us who are in positions to speak up and be heard and get uptake, those of us that can think about and talk about these issues as we are today, we might want to draw connections between those who, human animals who are suffering from the impacts of climate change and the truly voiceless animals who don't really speak. And so that to me raises my sort of a question that I wanted to sort of pose as I sort of wind down here, and that is what kinds of activities or thoughts or ideas might we bring to bear on how we might give voice to the grief of the voiceless? Because there's a danger. There's a danger speaking for others. There's always a danger that what we would be doing in speaking for others is projecting our own interests, being anthropomorphic, putting, in the case of animals, putting human ideas and human thoughts and human feelings onto beings that aren't human, or in some ways just projecting our own views onto those who were unable to hear. And so I have developed a view called entangled empathy that attempts to provide a set of tools for thinking about how we might be able to speak for or understand the situation of the voiceless. And part of what that involves is trying to bring our affect and our emotional engagement, our attachments and our concerns into a sort of process that's both emotional and cognitive or thoughtful with the experiences of the others. And in this case, the others who are at the sort of forefront of the changing climate. And so I think part of what might be a really useful way of thinking going forward is to try to understand from the perspective of those others how their lives are, what their relationships look like, and how we might better our relationships. to them. I'd start from a place of thinking that we're in these relationships already, and these relationships aren't particularly good relationships. And so one way that we might be able to do something in light of the grief of the voiceless is by looking hard at those relationships that we're in, the damage that we might cause in those relationships, as well as the pleasures that we cause in those relationships, and try to work to improve those relationships by both acknowledging the suffering that we may be responsible for, but also providing a more acceptable space for grief.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, that's a great contribution.
Great contribution. Now. Thank you so much, Lori.
Oh, my pleasure.
Have a good day. We'll be in touch soon with the recordings, and you will be able to hear also the other contributions from Clive and Ashley, who we also had on the line today.
Okay, that sounds terrific. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Have a wonderful day. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So tomorrow we have our last session. We have our last session from this cycle, back again to the normal schedule, 6:30 here in the room. And the session is called States of Reserve, the Legality of Invisible Regimes. And we'll have Cormac Cullinan, a lawyer and activist from South Africa, who has been doing extensive work for more than 30 years, mm-hmm. I guess, in the field of law and the rights of nature. Then we'll have Joana Rafael, Portuguese architect and researcher currently based in Milan, who has been dwelling with nuclear energy, time capsules, and also Paulo Tavares, who's in transition from Ecuador to the States. We will see how we'll catch him during his flight. And will talk to us also about the problematics of nature and of defense programs and nation states.
Thank you very much.